You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
Time for episode 64 of the Atomic Show podcast. Today is the 19th of July, 2007. My name is Rod Adams, and I'm coming to you today from a motel room in beautiful San Diego, California. I'm flying solo today, no guest, no co-host. For those of you like Robin and Alan who have complained about my inability to get the levels right from my usual Skype call podcast, you should enjoy this. With only one microphone to worry about, even I can figure out how to get it right. There have been some interesting developments in the atomic world in the past 3 weeks or so since the last episode of the show. I've written about some of them on my blog, Atomic Insights, www.atomicinsights.blogspot.com, but some deserve some additional attention and discussion. One of the biggest recent news items that come up when doing a search on the word nuclear power on Google News demonstrates just how far the pro-nuclear choir has to go in sharing the good news about atomic energy. An earthquake in Japan killed more than 10 people, destroyed more than 1,000 homes, and displaced more than 9,000 people early this week. It also caused a small transformer fire and sloshed some water from a used fuel storage pool at a nuclear power plant. Because of the special attention paid to nuclear matters, the spilled water, which was actually less radioactive than many natural springs where people bathe for relaxation, and transformer fire has been featured in thousands of headlines. There have been hundreds of editorials and letters to the editor already, with some predictably calling for an end to the use of nuclear power. It is time once again for some perspective. The safety-related structures at the plant site appear to have performed as designed. There is no indication of any permanent damage to the plant's ability to operate. Of course, the event is going to be extremely costly. The whole complex, with a total generating capacity of over 8,000 megawatts, may be shut down for a year or more for detailed inspections. At current world fuel prices, the replacement power alone for this plant is going to cost on the order of $16 million per day. Because of the size of the generating capacity that was lost by this single quake, that's probably an underestimation of the cost of replacement power. The increased demand from this plant shutdown alone will put enough pressure on the market price of replacement fuel to raise the price of that fuel. That effect will increase the longer that the nuclear plants remain out of service. This is one example that exposes the fallacy and fragility of the economy of scale. There is certainly an advantage in design and operating cost if you locate a mass of similar facilities in a single place, but there is also the risk of a single event that affects all of those facilities. Once again, I need to mention that nuclear plants are not uniquely vulnerable to earthquakes, and also need to mention that I have direct experience with nuclear plants that routinely operate on mobile ships at sea that shake more than any earthquake. It is a matter of design and scale. If you build relatively compact plants, you can mount them in such a way as to take the pounding of an earthquake, a depth charge, or even a full-speed collision into an undersea mountain. Earthquakes are very energetic natural events that can shake all man-made structures. Large nuclear plants are designed to withstand a certain amount of shaking, without causing any risk of immediate damage. But if they are shaken, they may need to be shut down for a lengthy period of inspection before they will be allowed to operate. Of course, there should be no surprise that the opponents of nuclear power will try to use the events at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear plant as part of their campaign against the technology. I want you all to think about this from a different perspective. What do you think that the effect would have been if the earthquake had occurred at the same magnitude at an oil refinery site? It might have produced some fireworks straight out of a James Bond or Steven Seagal movie. I want to talk a little bit about a recent effort by the Congressionally Directed Government Accountability Office to discredit the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's licensing program oversight. Here's the background. A few months ago, the GAO set up a sting operation to see how carefully the NRC is regulating the issuing of licenses for certain types of industrial devices that include a small amount of radioactive material. The specific devices in question were portable moisture density gauges with small amounts of cesium-137 and or americium-241, the same isotope used in smoke detectors. The devices were Category 4 materials, and that's on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being dangerous devices with major concern and major amounts of radioactivity, and 5 being devices of least concern, very small amounts of radioactive materials. The NRC procedure for reviewing the license application was pretty straightforward, and included some communication and faxing between the agency and the dummy corporation set up by the GAO. The GAO had got themselves a post office box, a fax machine, and a telephone number. They also incorporated in the state of Delaware, which has some fairly easy rules for incorporation. A license to purchase the moisture density gauges was issued by the NRC in approximately 28 days. It didn't include any site visits. That was something that the GAO thought was a problem. As a side note, the devices in question are in widespread industrial use, with thousands of them at construction sites all over the country. They are sealed sources that require a substantial effort to break open the seal and get to the radioactive material. The material itself is in a form that is not easy to disperse widely. There are many good technical reasons why the NRC has determined that these devices pose little threat to human health and should be relatively easy to obtain. They are very useful. There's also a good reason why the NRC has decided not to use some of its limited resources to increase the scrutiny of the applications for licenses for these devices. There really is little concern because although the devices could be used, if somebody is extremely dedicated and extremely competent to accumulate a certain amount of radioactive material, there still is a big hurdle in trying to figure out how to disperse that radioactive material in such a way as to endanger any human health. In contrast, the GAO also applied for a license from the state of Maryland, which is an agreement state and is allowed to issue sealed material licenses as well. Their review process was far more strict and included a requirement for a site visit. The communication between the NRC and the GAO estimated that it would take about 7 months to complete the process to issue a materials license for these standard industrial moisture detecting devices. Interestingly enough, I live in Maryland, have a friend who operates a mom and pop bakery in the state capital. As I recall, it took them about a year to get all the permits they needed to open that bakery. There's a reason why Maryland is viewed as one of the least business-friendly states in the country. The coverage of this story was pretty disheartening, especially when you hear commentary like I heard from one of my favorite technology podcasts, Geek News Central. Todd Cochran is one of the founding fathers of the podcast world. I think he started Geek News Central in the fall of 2004 using a $10 RadioShack microphone and a laptop while on travel as an aviation technician with the U.S. Navy. I want to play you a clip from his show so you can see what kind of effect this sting operation can have on the credibility of the NRC and the whole licensing process. Among even people who love technology and science, it is not just a problem for the technically inept parts of the media world. In the first part of the clip, you'll hear Todd getting excited about a website that he just found with an interesting display of an atomic structure.
Take your little cursor on your web browser and you scroll and you scroll and you scroll and you scroll all the way to the right. And all the way on the far right, there is an electron that's represented by one pixel. So what they've done is they've got the electron represented as one pixel, but then they have the proton as its relative size. So this gives the kids an understanding of, you know, what these elements look like. And this is great. It really, really is a great representation, and it make them go, hmm. And then if you talk about that a little bit, then they'll get a little better idea about the science of atoms and the actual representations here. So I hope you check it out. I think it's really, really cool. I like this kind of stuff when I find it. If you find cool stuff like this, it's educational that we can share, with you or with the audience here to help explain science and this kind of stuff. It's good for, they get kids' minds thinking. You know, there's too many, you know, there's not enough kids today that are interested in science and we gotta pique their brains a little bit with this kind of stuff, and it definitely will help them, you know, maybe open up some ideas on, you know, some career opportunities or, you know, some fields maybe that they'd want to pursue. Now, speaking of, you know, atoms and electrons and stuff like that, there's a report out, and it's on Reuters, and it says that a kind of a GAO sting operation was able to apply and get a nuclear license. This is simply amazing. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a license to a dummy corporation in just 28 days, which would have allowed them to buy enough radioactive material to build a dirty bomb. This is so amazing to me that they were able to do this. And what actually happened was, is they were able to get this license, and then they were actually able to very easily doctor it so that they could change the amount that they were going to be allowed to buy. And it's, how can this happen in this day and age with everything that's happened over the past 5 years? You would think there would be more oversight on this, but I'm sure our representatives in Congress and the GAO are going to have fun with this one here, as a Congressional Senate committee actually was the group that requested that the GAO do this. So we'll see what happens in the hearings on the fallout on this. Hopefully there's some big, big changes in the process to make sure this never happens again.
My call to you, my choir, is to get out there and help spread the word that dirty bombs are a chimera. There is far more danger from the bomb part than from any attempt to make the bomb dirty. The only way that terrorists will succeed in their goals by using these devices is if we allow them to make us afraid, to instill their terror. After hearing about this story, I posted a letter from a radiation health professional from my archives that provides excellent information about the real potential effects of a dirty bomb and how to respond. Once again, I have to mention my cynical bias. If you think about the sources of money for many terror cells, you can imagine why they have tried to make us even more afraid of radioactive materials and why efforts to further tighten restrictions on the use of those materials plays into their hands. It is no secret that the sale of oil provides much of the wealth for terror group sponsors, and it should be no surprise that any effort to discredit nuclear power helps to make energy more scarce and oil more valuable. On to new developments in new atomic power plants. I was intrigued a couple of days ago to learn that Kazakhstan is in negotiations with Toshiba for a slice of Westinghouse, the nuclear power plant development arm of that large multinational corporation. Longtime listeners of the Atomic Show or readers of Atomic Insights may recall that Toshiba purchased Westinghouse from BNFL, the UK government-owned corporation that used to be known as British Nuclear Fuels. The sale closed in early 2007 with a total sales price of $5.4 billion. Toshiba immediately sold 20% of the company to Shaw Group and 3% to Ishii Kawajima Harima Heavy Industries Company Limited, IHI. According to several different sources, Kazakhstan is going to be purchasing 10% of the company for about $486 million. Actually, it is not quite clear to me if that figure is 10% of Westinghouse or 10% of Toshiba's share of Westinghouse, which is about 77% of the company. If it is the former, the value per share in the company has dropped by 10% since the original sale closed. If it is the latter, the value per share has increased by about 16%. If anyone has any better information, I'd be interested in hearing from you. If there are any old-time Westinghouse executives still with the company, I would not be surprised if they are heavily involved with these negotiations. Back in the peak of the first nuclear era, Westinghouse ended up getting heavily distracted, spending about 10 years in court because of a mistake in its understanding of uranium as a commodity. They sold a bunch of plants with a long-term fuel supply included in the contract price, but the negotiators neglected to contract for the uranium needed to fulfill these obligations. The people involved were apparently banking on the fact that uranium prices had been stable or declining for several years, and they assumed that behavior would continue. In other words, they weren't worried about buying the uranium later. They figured the price would be the same or lower as it was when they made the contracts. What they did not understand was that their decision to sell plants with included fuel was, in effect, a short sale of uranium. They did not own the uranium they were selling with the plants, and by selling it, they were effectively reducing the current market demand for the metal. In other words, the customer who bought a plant with included uranium would not go out and buy uranium to supply the plant itself. That made the price of uranium stagnant, or even dropped a bit than it would have been without the sale. It caused the physical supply of the material to decline in the world markets. The reason for that is that some of the mines that were operating became unprofitable to operate. So they were simply shut down, which over time makes less and less uranium available. Once Westinghouse had to actually purchase the physical material needed to make good on their contracts, they were faced with rapid price increases in the metal because of their own demand and the fact that there was less supply available. Their short sales had put them in a short squeeze. Of course, some executives, notably John Simpson, the guy whose book gave me the background for this story, never admitted their errors. They always claimed that they were the victims of a global cartel. That's why they spent so much time in court. They lost about $1 billion and were trying to recoup money from the cartel or from their customers. But others who were involved in the effort may have gotten a clue and determined they would never again sell uranium they did not own. One way to make sure that happens is to have a partner like Kazakhstan, which has some of the world's richest and highest growth potential uranium mines. As another part of this story, I read recently that Kazakhstan has announced that it is going to stop supplying uranium ore to its customers, like Russia. Instead, it will be using Westinghouse technology to manufacture finished products like uranium or nuclear fuel rods, which have far more value than raw uranium ore. Interesting. Of course, there are some people like James Love at the Huffington Post who are not happy with the prospects of selling part of Westinghouse to a country like Kazakhstan. It's amusing to me how many of these commentators have not figured out that Westinghouse stopped being an American company about a dozen years ago when the original industrial giant morphed into a media company called CBS, and CBS sold off the nuclear business to BNFL, British Nuclear Fuels Limited. One of my favorite sources of information and discussions about energy is a blog called Energy Outlook. It is written by Jeff Stiles, an energy industry consultant and former oil company marketing executive. He's also got a lot of experience on the trading desk. I was extremely intrigued by a recent post titled Rethinking Nuclear. Though Jeff is not opposed to nuclear energy, his blog normally focuses on oil, coal, gas, and traditional alternatives. He doesn't spend much time talking about nuclear power, and when he does, he normally talks about conventional nuclear plants and their challenges. In the Rethinking Nuclear post, however, it almost seemed like Jeff has been reading some of the material from Atomic Insights, Adam's Atomic Engines, listening to the Atomic Show podcast, or maybe reading Thorium Power. Because the post talks about approaching nuclear development from a new direction that includes smaller plants, new markets, and new fuels. There's quite a thread now attached to the post with more than 20 comments and counting. You might want to visit that and add your 2 cents. I will put a link to this story in the show notes. As a solo show, I would think I will try a shorter format than normal. So we're almost done. I did want to mention that one of the reasons there has been a shortage of shows recently, aside from the fact that I've lost my partner, been unsuccessful in locating any fill-in guests, apparently have Skype bad breath or something, that there's been continuing work and progress on Atomic Engines. No darn announcements yet. That's a code word for NDA. But there is growing hope that the dreams of our tiny company may one day, in the not-too-distant future, reach a point where we will be able to show the world what we have been talking about for so long. It's hard to explain to people just why I have put so much time and effort with just paper and ideas to show for it, but I guess I'm a more patient person than most of my friends and associates. I know that I'm more patient than my wife and the wives of all the other folks that are helping me out with this project. It takes time to build a foundation, and foundation builders are often charged with doing their work in a place where few people take notice. I want to thank all of you for listening, for all the positive comments you've given me, especially on my post asking if anybody missed the Atomic Show. It's nice to have an outlet for my passion. For those of you who are already excited about nuclear power and its prospects, spread the word. Never fear if you think that just because you are part of the pro-nuclear choir, that people do not want to learn more about the technology. We know some really valuable material here. It is our sacred obligation to share that knowledge with the world. If you have friends that you think might be interested, point them in the direction of the Atomic Show. Could use the listeners and use more feedback. The more people we have listening and talking and sharing ideas, the better the show will be. So take care. Hope you enjoyed the solo effort. And send in your cards and letters. You can reach me at rod_adams@atomicinsights.com. Adios.
G'day, this is Cameron Riley, CEO of the Podcast Network. I do a little show called GdayWorld.com, one of the longest-running podcasts on the planet. Last week for guests, we had Brian Dalton, the genius behind one of the big hit video podcasts out there, MrDeity.com. We also had a spokesperson from American Atheists on the show. And coming up next week, we've got a spokesperson for the Australian Skeptics Organisation and a couple of astronomers and physicists here to explain the wonderful world of the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. I hope you'll be able to join us at g'dayworld.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. Atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.